This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the historian Orlando Figes, speaking with us today about the Crimean War, which most people these days associate with Florence Nightingale and the charge of the Light Brigade. But in your new book, Orlando, you say that the Crimean War was the first truly modern war, also a major turning point in the 19th century history of Europe, Russia, and the Middle East. How so? Who were the combatants, and what did they think was at stake?
It was, I think, the first modern war, and has so many resonances for today's world in the sense that it really was a religious war. And I think for a long time, historians lost sight of the importance of religion for modern geopolitical conflicts. Here in the Crimean War, it really began as a conflict between the Orthodox and the Catholics over the control of the Holy Lands, in particular, who would have control over the keys and the roof of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. And the book starts with some scenes of fighting between monks and priests and pilgrims who had all come to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre at Easter and started battling among themselves as to who was to have first right to the holy altar.
What year?
This was, well, I begin in 1846 when about 30 people were killed in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre itself, some of them with sort of chalices and bits of the church roof itself. But the conflict really begins in 1853 when the Russians tried to impose their way on the Ottomans who controlled the Holy Lands, as they had done over many years in recent decades, by invading the principalities, which is essentially what today we think of as Romania, which were loosely controlled by the Ottomans, but on many occasions have been invaded by the Russians, and they do so again in 1853 to try and get their way in the Holy Lands dispute against the claims of the Catholics.
Orlando, the Ottomans are Muslims, the Russians are Christian.
So that was a great paradox, which I think has remained to this day a source of great resentment among the Russians, that the Western powers come to the side of the Ottomans to defend Ottoman sovereignty against this Russian invading force.
So we have Christians on the side of Muslims.
Of an Islamic power, exactly.
Fighting other Christians.
Exactly, which is a twist to what today seems also familiar, I suppose, in the sense that the Western powers who came to the aid of the Ottomans saw the Ottoman Empire as a place that they could reform in their own image, impose liberal administrative practices on them. The British were particularly interested in bringing in free trade to Turkey. And they saw Russia as a great threat to Europe and to the Near East, an expanding power. And much of the sort of rhetoric that we had in the Cold War, I suppose, of the defense of Western liberties against Russia comes into play in the defense of the Ottoman Empire against the Russians. And for the Western powers, I think in particular, the idea of reform seemed to them the solution to the Eastern question, which is what all this was rooted in. Namely, what was going to happen to the Ottoman Empire if all the Christians under Ottoman rule, we're talking now of the Balkan Christians mainly, about 15 million Christians, most of them Orthodox, were to break away from Ottoman control. Under the Ottomans, those Balkan Christians mainly suffered a number of practices of discrimination against them. And the Western powers backed the Ottomans on the assumption that they could also persuade them to reform on a Western lines of liberalism, good administrative practice, religious toleration.
Echoes of what's going on today in the Middle East.
Absolutely. I think the Western powers came to the defense of the Ottoman Empire partly because they saw it as a place that they could influence and wrest from the domination of the Russians, as it was increasingly coming under the control of the Russians at that time. But also, I think, because they saw it as an important sort of moderate state that they could influence and use, especially for the British, I think, to expand their commercial empire in the Near East. They were interested in trade routes to India, which, of course, had to go through the Ottoman Empire. And I think for the French, there was this added factor of religious influence. The French took very seriously the question of their sort of historic mission going back to the Crusades, where they had an interest in the Holy Lands. And the Catholic ultramontane influence on Napoleon III in this run-up to the Crimean War was particularly influential.
Get us to the beginning of hostilities.
Yeah, well, it's a sort of unnecessary war in some ways, because the Russians invade the principalities to impose their will on the Turks over this Holy Lands dispute. And the Turks put up quite a good resistance. And then the Austrians, who'd been sort of sitting on the sidelines and whose role would be absolutely crucial here because the Russians couldn't really take on the Turks with Austrians mobilizing, do precisely that, bring up troops to the border. And the Russians get scared. They think they're going to be fighting against a war of the whole of Europe. Nicholas I, this the Tsar of Russia at the time, who sees, I think, the defense of the Orthodox as sufficient cause for war and is prepared to fight against the whole of Europe, is finally persuaded by his senior generals to retreat. So the Turks have essentially repulsed the Russians, who've crept back into their own territories.
This is on the eastern shore of the Black Sea.
Absolutely. They've come in from Odessa through Romania and are marching towards Istanbul, Constantinople as it was then. And the Turks have pushed them back, and the Western powers, the British and the French, have landed expeditionary forces in Bulgaria. Many of them come down with cholera, but the Russians have essentially retreated by this stage. So the French and the British have a choice. They can either go home and try and impose some sort of threat against the Russians not to do it again, or, as they decide, they in fact then launch an expedition to invade Russia, and that's essentially what it was, an invasion of Russia, by sending their troops across the Black Sea to land in the Crimea. The flotilla is a massive expeditionary force, mostly with steamships, but also large sailing boats, which were also going to be bringing in supplies. And that was going to be the big problem of this war, a little bit like the wars we're seeing today with expeditionary forces in Afghanistan and the Near East. How do you supply them? That was the main problem in the Crimea. And this force had encamped in the plains of Varna in Bulgaria, come down with cholera, which was sweeping across Southeast Europe at this stage. And to some extent, the decision of the British and the French to launch the invasion of Russia was simply to get the troops out of this cholera-infested swamp, as the Danube Delta was at that time. So they land in the Crimea and miss an opportunity, I think, to impose miss an opportunity to gain a quick victory against the Russians. They defeat them in the first sort of traditional battle, fought, I suppose, in many ways like the Napoleonic Wars 30, 40 years before, at the Battle of Ulma, which is a battle of swift movement, cavalry charges, infantry, who find their chief advantage in the long-range rifle that the French have invented, the Minier rifle, which the British have at their disposal as well, and which can pick off the Russian cannon before they come in range of those heavy guns that the Russians had mounted on the Ulma Heights. The Russians are forced off those heights, retreat to Sevastopol, their main naval base in the Crimea, and the French and British, instead of marching into Crimea as they could have done, virtually unopposed at that point, decide, I suppose because they're badly informed by intelligence as to how well guarded Sevastopol is, decide to launch a siege in the manner of traditional siege warfare, sail round to the southern side of Sevastopol instead of walking in unopposed from the north. And there begins an 11-month siege, which, as I say, I think in the book, really is the first modern war. If the Battle of the Alma only a few days before had been the last sort of traditional battle fought in the manner of the Napoleonic Wars, then the siege of Sevastopol is a dress rehearsal in many ways for the trench warfare of the First World War. I suppose Americans like to think of the first modern war as the American Civil War, and in many ways, I suppose the American Civil War has at least an equal claim to that title in the way that it involves civilian populations and is a total war. The Crimean War also became a total war in that sense. There were waves of ethnic cleansing. Civilian populations were affected, if not only just by disease, by the movement of troops and requisitioning of their foodstuffs, but also because it was a religious war, politics became involved. The populations of the combatant nations became involved in decision-making because there was the telegraph, the first war reporters bringing back news from the front to people's breakfast tables only a day or two later. Public opinion was outraged by the poor supply of the troops out in the Crimea. But above all, it was the first modern war in the sense that here was heavy artillery. The Russians were well equipped with artillery. It was the one area of warfare they had developed in the last 20 to 30 years. And they were at least the match of the British and the French, who had heavier guns but were to some extent dependent on firing them from unstable positions, first at sea and then digging into trenches, but finding their match in the Russians. So literally millions of shells of various calibre were fired from these trenches. There was warfare through sapping and mining, and it was a war of attrition in which the industrialised economies of Britain and France won out, but only eventually and at great cost, through shipping in supplies, heavy caliber shells by sea, where the Russians, a non-industrial power, were dependent on peasant carts and horses bringing in supplies and muddy roads, and lacked the industrial warfare capability, and above all, perhaps the railways, in order to see it through.
Talk about the competence of the officers.
Well, the main commander of the British Army was Lord Raglan, who had been the military secretary to the Duke of Wellington in the Peninsular Wars, and he had one arm, not much sense, and had never really commanded major forces in warfare. So he was pretty much a geriatric general and indecisive, made many military blunders. The Russians had slightly better commanders, I suppose, and certainly they had a cast of military professionals and engineers who saw them through the long siege of Sevastopol, where Gortchakov and then Menshikov to a lesser degree, but certainly Todleben, the engineer, showed themselves to be quite well equipped for long siege warfare. And Tolstoy, one of the characters in the book that I write about, the writer Leo Tolstoy, was in the siege of Sevastopol, is full of praise for some of these Russian commanders who were military professionals in a sense. And the French, I think, in some ways had the best commanders and the most up-to-date military forces. They had been involved in wars in Algeria, and their Zouaves, the shock infantry brigades, who were terribly brave, good at fighting in terrain similar to the Crimea, very, very brave, good sharpshooters, had their own sort of corps d'esprit and a sort of closeness to their military commanders that I think had been born to some extent from the French Revolution. And that closeness and military professionalism on the side of the French was to set them apart, I think, from the other military commands, and was to become an advantage for both the British and the Russians, who were to try to modernize their armies in the manner of the French to some extent, as a result of the calamities that took place in the Crimean War.
And the Turks, the Ottomans, where they also fielded troops when...
Yeah, the Turks did a lot better than I think the press and certainly the British gave them credit for. The British and the French had rather colonial attitudes towards the Turkish troops, many of whom were from North Africa, Tunisia, and saw them, I think, as they looked upon them as little better than sort of colonial servants, really. But the Turks did well in the battles in the principalities in 1853-54, and were certainly a match for the Russians. They took the blame for the defeat of the British at the Battle of Balaclava, where the famous charge of the Light Brigade took place, because they had run away from the redoubts that were in the advanced positions trying to fend off the Russian cavalry charges. They had been badly provided with ammunition. They'd only just arrived on the battle scene themselves. They'd been given very little to eat. So the British, who were slightly embarrassed by their defeat at the charge of the Light Brigade, blamed a lot of that on the Turks and put them really to the use of just sort of bringing up supplies from Balaclava to the Alma Heights or digging trenches instead of using them to fight. You know, the British also, in a way that is, I think, quite scandalous, played upon Turkish-Russian religious divides. So, for example, when the British... and this is an aspect of the war which I think is quite modern. I mean, ethnic cleansing, if we can call it, that was certainly a factor in the Crimean War. When the British launched, the Anglo-French, in fact, launched their invasion of the Kerch Peninsula on the eastern side of the Crimea, they turned a blind eye to the Turkish civilian population and the Turkish troops they used there, who carried out reprisals against the Russian Orthodox population. And a number of churches were destroyed. A famous museum Museum with ancient Christian remains was destroyed, and there was a good deal of rape and looting, which the British turned their eye to, a blind eye to.
Also, the cutting off of the ears of the dead and trying to turn them in for a reward.
Yes, this was part of Ottoman military practice that. And where the Crimean War, I think, fits into a longer tradition of Russo-Turkish wars that were fought along really a religious fault line between Islam and Christianity running from the Balkans through to the Caucasus. And on that fault lines, wars were fought in really quite a savage way, and churches would be looted and destroyed. There would be the mutilation of bodies, motivated partly, I think, by religious hatred, but also by this Ottoman practice of rewarding soldiers for the number of men they'd killed, proven by the number of body parts they could bring back, ears typically. And that was practice in the siege of Silistria, which was part of Romania, where the Turks held off the Russians in 1853. And it was certainly a part of the fighting in the Caucasus.
The scale of the casualties is horrific. How many people die, not only from wounds, but also from disease?
We see it as a sort of minor war, rather silly, unnecessary war, but actually I see it as a major hinge event of the 19th century, and the casualties reflect that. My estimate is that something in the region of 750,000 people died as a direct result of the fighting, including those in the combatant forces dying from disease, which was probably the majority of them. Probably also two-thirds of that, three-quarters of a million, were Russians. And we simply don't know how many Russians died. I mean, something probably in the region of a quarter of a million are buried in unmarked graves in and around Sevastopol. The British lost much fewer, only a few thousand. The French considerably more, although they sent 300,000 troops as opposed to the 90,000 British. And the Turks also lost considerable numbers because they'd been fighting in 1853-4 before the French and the British arrived. So we're talking about, in 19th century terms, we're talking about really quite a major war. And as to the civilian casualties, that's impossible to tell. I mean, civilian populations were obviously affected by diseases spread by armies on the move, by the destruction of crops and houses caught in the crossfire. I mean, these armies thought nothing of bombing major towns, like Taganrog was bombed from a distance by the Allied fleets.
Say something about the long siege of the city. How many months and... Give me an idea of the shelling and the amount of bombs dropped in the destruction.
Yeah, I mean, the siege of Sevastopol is really, in terms of casualties, the centrepiece of the war. And it lasted 11 months. The British and French digging into trenches and meter by meter moving towards the Russian fortifications and bombing indiscriminately a city where at least 100,000 civilians lived. And that bombing involved something like 5 million heavy bombs and shells, 150 million gunshots. They dug 120 kilometers of trenches around the city from which they were bombing it for 11 months.
When the city falls, is that the end of the war?
Well, it is effectively the end of the war. It didn't have to be because, as Alexander II, the Tsar by that stage, said to his population, Sevastopol is not Russia. And it was, just the little toe of that large empire. But the symbolic significance of the loss of Sevastopol was great enough for the French, who were by this stage the major players on the Allied side, to say, look, enough is enough. Napoleon III by this stage was wary of resistance in the army to the idea of going another winter in the war. The French population was showing distinct signs of war weariness. And he was more interested in getting Russia on his side to begin his campaign in northern Italy against the Austrians, and he needed the Russians on side for that. So having gained the symbolic significance of the victory in Sevastopol, the French were quite happy to wind it up at that stage. The British, who I think were always fighting a punitive war against Russia to reduce the size of the empire. Palmerston had elaborate plans. Lord Palmerston, the Prime Minister of Britain, very anti-Russian, had elaborate plans to dismember the Russian Empire and was determined to continue the war, as indeed was Queen Victoria. But without the French backing, They were not going to make much headway, and the Russians were ready for peace at this stage in any case. So Sevastopol was effectively the end. But boy, what a price did they pay. Having lost Sevastopol, the Russians at the peace of Paris peace in 1856 were effectively demilitarized in the Black Sea. That doesn't sound much perhaps to us today, but if you think about it and the strange geography of Russia, the Black Sea covers the entire southern border of Russia, and it's the most vulnerable border because there it has the Ottoman Empire on the other side of the Black Sea, and it has the Caucasus, which it couldn't control then, still can't control today, in the southeast. And the great fear of Russia was that any Western power could sail freely into the Black Sea and arm Russia's enemies in the Caucasus or in Turkey, and the Islamic population of that area may well side against Russia's enemies and bring down the Russian Empire. So if you think about it, the demilitarization of the Black Sea was a major humiliation for the Russians. It had never happened to a major power before. The Concert of Europe, on which the 19th century balance of power was based, had always reasoned that no major power, and Russia clearly was a major power, should be humiliated. But that's exactly what the Western powers did to Russia in 1856.
That last question, Orlando, and what was the long-term consequences of that? I mean, that shapes the attitudes of the Russians toward Europe for the next 100 years. What attitude comes from the out of Britain and France?
I think it certainly shaped Russian attitudes to the West and continues to shape them today, in the sense that the Russians saw this as a betrayal by the West. Here they had sided with an Islamic power against a Christian power, against an ally. And that humiliation meted out to the Russians in 1856 was very sorely felt by the Russians, who I think had always felt in any case that there was a double standard practiced by the Western powers. You know, it was okay for the West to go and invade half of the world and colonize it. But when the Russians had marched into the principalities to defend their co-religionists, the Western powers had, you know, cried foul.
Thank you, Orlando Figes, for speaking with us today about the Crimean War. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2011.